Hello, 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 and welcome to this week's episode of the College Investor Live. I am having an awesome money conversation this morning with Dr. Brad Klontz. He is a financial psychologist and the author of so many books. And honestly, I didn't know all of that, or any of that really, I should say, until like 2 or 3 years ago when I found him on TikTok. And he was actually one of the few individuals throwing out amazing financial advice and debunking a lot of myths. And then I went down this rabbit hole and I'm like, oh my God, I should have intersected with Brad maybe like 20, 30 times on my financial journey and in the personal financial media community. And I don't know how I never did, but I'm super glad we finally connected and we've met in person a couple times now. And I am excited to have Dr. Brad on the show. So Brad, you want to introduce yourself? Tell everybody about yourself. Say hi.
Well, thank you for that. It was a pleasure to meet you. I think the first time we met, we were sitting down for dinner. It was kind of
Yeah, fun. Totally.
So I'm not surprised you hadn't heard of me. I'm kind of shy. I try to avoid social media. And I'm a financial psychologist. So I got a doctorate in clinical psychology. I very quickly learned that I didn't know what I needed to know about money. I ended up getting $100,000 in student loan debt, which I know many people watching this can relate to. I was terrified by having all that debt. I grew up in a lower income family. I didn't know anything about investing. Basically, I was extremely vulnerable for very, very bad financial advice. And not only was I vulnerable, I actually took that advice and I acted upon it, which I know we're going to be talking about TikTok and why I got on there. But really, I got into day trading, Robert. I don't know if I ever told you that. I had a friend of mine who I saw make $100,000 in 1 year trading stocks. And I remember sitting next to him on the computer and he's buying a stock. I won't mention the ticker symbol, although I do remember this. And I'm like, boom. He goes, I just bought 200 shares. And he was doing it on margin. I'm like, what is it? He's like, I have no idea. Cackle. And I saw him, I saw him make $100,000 doing this. I'm like, I could do that. So I sold everything I had of value. I'm a pretty extreme person when it comes to this sort of thing. And then I put it all in the stock market and I started to trade with it. And then 3 months later, the tech bubble burst. Oh, and I sat there and I watched my money melt away. And I was like, the question I asked myself, why would a reasonably intelligent person do something so stupid with his money? And I've been trying to figure out that out for the next 20 years.
I love it. I did not know of your day trading story. And it, you know, it's eerily similar to mine. I didn't get into day trading, but I definitely got into trading. And, you know, you feel amazing when you have those winners, right? And like, oh my God, I like 3x'd my money. But then, you know, soon enough, you're reverting back to the mean and failing. And you suddenly realize that, you know, it's not really a great way to build long-term wealth, and it's not really sustainable. And you know what? It's honestly a lot of work. So I also think that when you see these day traders on social media specifically, because, you know, they highlight themselves a lot on there, you know, to be, let's just say, even reasonably successful, these people are putting in a lot of time, a lot of effort, you know,
I'm calling BS. They're not. There's nobody who's reasonably successful.
Well, yeah. Maybe. Okay, but let's just say hypothetically. You know, let's just say you're Wall Street, right? Like, you know, I always think of these Wall Street towers of, you know, all these companies. They're investing time, resources, money, supercomputers, tons of labor, and over 10 years, they're reverting back to the mean too. Like, what's the statistic? You know it better than me probably, but like, you know, 95% of mutual funds don't beat the S&P 500 over 10 years, something like that.
Yeah, it's abysmal. And they have, and I always think about me back then and in the average investor out there, these people have entire teams of PhDs in finance. They actually fly in their private jets over to these companies and they review their books and they walk around and you know, only 5% of them are beating the market. You know, they have supercomputers, all of this. They're investing everything they have into this. What makes you think you can, you know? And I've read the studies on day trading, and it's actually hard to get the data because why if I'm making money on day traders, why would I want to release their results? But the ones I have seen, and a lot of these are international, 97% of day traders lose money. 3% make money, but only one of those three individuals make more than minimum wage.
Oh my gosh. It's
an abysmal approach to getting wealthy. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, oh, but I'll be one of that 1%. And my answer to you is no, you won't. You know, I mean, I wish you could, but
right.
Big part of the education for me was learning that that is actually not how rich people invest. That's not how people get rich, and that's not how rich people invest. And when I was younger, I thought that's what they do. They must sit around and, you know, with all this insider information, making all these trades, and that's how you become rich. It's actually, that's not what they do at all.
And I love that you call that out. So why don't we just jump right into that? Because I feel like that's really kind of one of your staples that caught my attention when you started on TikTok a couple years ago. And you always had the really sexy intros, but you're like, hey, do you want to be a millionaire? You know, like, and then you dive into like the real hard facts. But like, how do people become rich? I think it's a great starting point, right?
Yeah, it really is. And certainly something that I wanted to know growing up lower income. And we're being fed all these lies. Like, this is the stuff that is just, I find so fascinating. And I'm hungry for the truth. And so I'm willing right now to abandon anything I ever thought was true. If you have some data to show me that my thinking was wrong, is not only am I willing to do it, I'm excited to do it. Okay. But, you know, the easiest way to talk about it are some myths. Okay. So there's been some surveys, there's not a ton of data on this, but, you know, Millionaire Next Door did a couple, you know, Stanley Thomas did a couple studies on this. And what he found is 70% of millionaires are employees or professionals. Okay. That's 7 out of 10. So what that tells you is there's only 3% of them are entrepreneurs. So they're becoming millionaires by being entrepreneurs. You're an entrepreneur, Robert. I'm an entrepreneur. 7 out of 10 entrepreneurs go belly up. I mean, I get why, you know, that's not the majority of people who are hitting that millionaire status. They're employees or professionals. They have day jobs. They go to the office. And really what they're doing is they are saving and investing a percentage of every dollar they make. And a lot of these individuals are doing it through their 401ks or their IRAs. And, you know, you just can't beat the statistics. If you do that, and what I do on social media too, and you maybe see this, I try to make it simple. So I use an example, investing $5 a day, getting average market returns which over the last 100 years is over 10% a year, is $1 million in 42 years. Mm-hmm. Very simple math. That's $5 a day. Just as an example of that power of the discipline of setting money aside. And to be honest, that is the primary way that people are becoming millionaires right now in the United States. It's over time and it's saving and investing a percentage of every dollar they make.
And I love it because, you know, before I was an entrepreneur, quote unquote, I used to work as a Target store manager. I don't know if you knew that. I did that for 17 years. And before I left Target, my 401k was pushing about $200,000. And this is from starting it. I think Target had a rule, like I couldn't even start till 21 because of their plan guidelines. So that's from like 21 to 28, between saving as much as I possibly could, getting the employer match, because gotta love the free money. And, you know, seeing that compound growth, right, from the returns of the stock market, that's a great way. And if I kept doing that for another 10, 15 years, it would have ballooned into being $1 million 401k too. And I think people really dismiss it because I hate seeing all the, I'll say insurance salesmen, but there's others that prey on them on social media too. And they always say the 401k is bad and the IRA is bad and you're going to get eaten alive by fees and all this random stuff, which you know is not true, but they're preying on these people.
I literally had somebody today in that genre on Facebook. I had a video around and I said the market returns, average market returns, 10%. I always use that as an example because that's the average. That's the S&P 500. And this person literally put in my thing, well, if you want to 3X that, I can get you 3X that return. And then threw up, I'm like, please, I know what's coming next. I said, don't do it. And then they, of course, did it. And of course, it's an insurance product. By the way, I'm pro insurance. I'm not trying to say anything bad about insurance. But I mean, what got me on TikTok was the misinformation. So I literally was watching videos. My nephews were young. They're like, check out this cat, Uncle Brad. I'm looking at it. And then I flip up and then there's a day trader selling day trading. And I was so mad. That's why I started making content on TikTok. I'm like, we just have to educate people about the truth around this stuff. Because what they're doing is they're preying on people who are like me. People who are like me when I was growing up, lower income. I didn't know. I don't know what rich people do. I don't know how to get rich. I know being poor sucks. Those are the people that they're targeting, and those are the people who get hurt the most and they need the most help.
Well, absolutely. And I think that you have to realize the product that, you know, let's just say someone that has $50 million or some outrageous amount of money needs is a very different financial thing than someone that's trying to make ends meet, that's budgeting, that's just out of college, that's working a 9-to-5 job and trying to get ahead. Like, you know, they have different risks and different needs and different things. So they might want something that has zero downside risk, and they're willing to pay a hefty price to protect that. Where when you're young, you might not need that product or want that product, or it's too expensive because you have a competition. I always like to say the competition for dollars. Like if we all had infinite funds, like go for it, you go hog wild. But like we don't, right? We have a little bit we can put to our 401k and maybe our IRA, and we're trying to save for a house and pay down our debt, right? Like it's this battle of where we spend our money.
Yeah, you have assets that need protection. Like I have insurance. I have insurance products. I don't have any of the insurance products that they're peddling. And I also work with a lot of ultra rich individuals, and literally zero of them have those products. I'll just be honest with you. But we all have insurance. Insurance is very important. And it's to protect an asset or, you know, your income that people are relying on. It has a very important place in financial planning. But to your point, like when I'm starting out, I didn't have any assets. I had some risk, like risk of dying and making sure that my income, my family could, you know, have a term life insurance policy to support, you know, to replace my income. Definitely need auto insurance. You definitely want some health insurance, probably want some homeowner insurance. But the thing that bothers me with any product, you know, there are ways that to misuse it, ways you don't need it. And the thing that really gets me on social media is the people who, as you mentioned, are typically salespeople who are selling get rich quick schemes, buy my day trading course, you know, and it's just, it's terrible because they're preying on people who actually can't afford it, but are the ones who are most motivated to not be poor.
Yep. And last week I had Bobby Hoyt on the show, and he's Millennial Money Man. And we talked a lot about side hustles. And one of the things that came up a lot is we're seeing this reversion. So I would say before the pandemic, side hustles were popular. Then the pandemic came, a lot of people got stimulus, you know, a lot of that edge got taken off the economy. Right. But I would say over the last 3 to 6 months, we've seen like this increase in searching for it, questions about it, demand, which tells me that people are starting to get, you know, needy again. They're hurting a little bit. Which is also when people get preyed on the most on these platforms because they need that get rich quick because they're looking at their budget and they're like, I have to make ends meet this month.
Well, to your point too, I noticed a very big difference in the last month on my TikTok feed and social media feeds where now I'm seeing the crypto people back and the day trading people back and the stock pickers back. And so they all went away for the last 6 months. Because they knew they weren't going to be making a lot of money trying to sell this because people got so burned by it, you know, from their last video. I used to make videos too where these people would say, you know, these 6 stocks will make you rich, you know, and then I would 6 months later, I would just be standing next to it, pointing out the returns in the last 6 months for those 6 stocks. And so there's just, it's just another example of terrible financial information where even if it's a reliable source, somebody telling you, you know, this stock is a good pick. Are they going to call you, you know, the day that it's not, you know, I mean, where are you going to get your exit information from those individuals? And the answer is that, as we mentioned before, even the best traders on Wall Street are going to lose 95% of the time based over time, based on the S&P 500. And so it's just the wrong way to go about it. That's not what rich people do. Rich people, what they honestly do is they focus on making more money, but more importantly, saving and investing more money. I know people who make $40,000, $50,000 a year who are millionaires. And I know people who make $200,000 a year and have almost zero net worth. I mean, if you, the key is the mindset around every dollar I get, there's a chunk of that I'm going to pay myself first with.
Well, and I think that's kind of now what I know you most as is like this money script mindset psychology guy of money. And I really like the behavioral finance stuff because I truly do believe that everything that you need to know about money, you've learned mathematically in second grade. If you can add, subtract, do a little multiplication, you have mastered all the fundamental like math skills that you need to handle your money. The rest of it's all in here. Like it's all like the psychology, right?
Well, of course, I agree with you.
Oh, yeah.
That the psychology is most important. But to your point, you know, the average American is in terrible financial shape. The average American is one of the richest human beings on planet Earth. That's the other thing you need to just recognize, let alone in history. Okay. And we all know better. I mean, the biggest mistakes we're having is we're spending more than we make and we're not saving for the future. And, you know, we have credit card debt. And I challenge you to find somebody in the United States who doesn't know better around these things. So that's where I think education is important to a degree, but that's not what's tripping most of us up.
Yeah. So, I mean, I also kind of view it's like fitness, right? We all know we should eat healthy, but then you're staring down that cheeseburger and you're like, oh, but I just want that. And I'm going to follow it with a shake and dessert. And then you're like, why did I gain 5 pounds? Like, you know, we have this disconnect. So how do you change some of that mindset? Like, you know, like where do you move? Like you said, you didn't grow up with a lot of money. So, and you day traded. So like at some point in time though, you had this, you know, a switch flipped in you and you're like, I shouldn't do these things. Like what was that journey and what can we learn from it?
Money. And then sitting back and realizing, oh, I got sucked into this. Like I thought that I could take 10 grand and turn it into 100,000 in a year. And what I've discovered is that is a poor mindset. So I talk a lot about rich mindset, poor mindset. It's a great example of a poor mindset. A poor mindset cobbles together some money and then tries to put it in this risky investment to like blow up and make it big. That is not what wealthy people do. That's not a wealthy people mindset. That's not how people get wealthy. That's how people lose their little nest egg. And that's what's going to happen to you if you have that approach. And so for me, it was sitting in the pain of that going, I need to learn about what people actually do. Because I clearly have no clue. And I think that's the point you need to get to is sort of this humble understanding that you are getting the results you're getting in life right now because of your beliefs, because of your understanding, because of your mindset, your upbringing. And if you want to get something different, you're going to have to challenge those beliefs. You're going to have to change them. And one of the things I started to do is study self-made millionaires. And I did that through a variety of methodologies. First one is like reading books like Millionaire Next Door. And then in my career, I started to actually conduct studies myself, looking at what is their psychology? How does the psychology of ultra high net worth individuals differ from the psychology of middle class and poor people? And so I've done a bunch of studies on that, by the way. They've been published in journals, psychological journals, to try to help understand that.
Love it. I mean, that's really where it starts, is trying to understand what people really do, because there is this social disconnect on social media of what people are being sold that people do and what they don't. But I also feel like we live in this era because of social media of instant gratification. And I got a bunch of comments near the end of the year and right now in tax season, because people are getting their tax documents and they're like, I invested and I made like a 9% return. And now my $1,000 is worth $1,090. And you know, you're like, 9% return, that's amazing. But like, they don't feel very good because the dollar value isn't great yet. And you know, it takes time. It got to compound. You got to keep adding to it. But because that instant gratification's there, it's very hard to get people to continue doing what they're doing.
I thought you were going to say that then they then had to calculate their short-term capital gains from making a bunch of trades. Because you want to take that 9% and you want to cut it in half again, do a bunch of trading along the way. And that's something that a lot of people don't really take into consideration.
Oh, I get it. I saw a thing on Reddit the other day that was hilarious because it was in the tax forum and someone had day traded $24 million and they had $150,000 in wash sales and their cost basis was like $23 million. So for $24 million in trades, they ended up making like $6,000 for the whole year.
Oh gosh.
I know. Crazy. And the all these accountants were roasting them because they're like, I'm going to charge the guy more for tax preparation because of all of these trades than he made trading last year.
Well, and running the risk of losing it all. I mean, that's the other thing that you got to take into account. Like what level of risk are you taking on for that very meager return?
Absolutely. So I think one of the other things that I always hear is, you know, more money will make you happier. I think it's your number one money script is more money will make you happier. And I think that's also what leads people to some of these desperate ploys, is that they're not satisfied with their job or their life or whatnot. And they're trying to find an outlet, an answer, and happiness is usually a driver of that. So I don't know, what are your thoughts on that? How do you shift that mindset?
Yeah. So the whole money and happiness thing is a real interesting thing. Now, I'm going to approach it as a scientist. So there have been a lot of studies that have said that there's no association between money and happiness above essentially what's middle class. And it's actually not true. So there's been a much, much better studies that have been done recently that show that actually it keeps trending up. So your happiness factor is going to grow as you get more money. And so let me just point that one out. And if you grew up not having money and now you do, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Like life is better, isn't it? However, it's not going to solve the big problems in life. And the big problems in life are around connection, around meaning in life. And this is why you see people who have everything in the world who are depressed and who, contemplate that life isn't worth living. This is something that happens. And what's interesting about it is that sometimes we're more vulnerable to that when we believe that money is going to solve all our problems. It's going to make me happy. And the other thing we do is we associate with stuff. So we tend to buy more stuff with that money script, which is why it's associated with terrible financial outcomes. You know, this new car is going to make me happy. If I can just buy this new piece of clothing, it's going to make me happy. This new handbag, these new shoes. And what you realize is it actually never leads to lasting happiness. And then unfortunately, and I work with a lot of people who this has happened to. So like entertainers, people who've come into very large sums of money. It's fabulous. It's an exciting thing. A year later, you realize, oh my gosh, actually this money, this fame, this fortune, it doesn't change who I am. And it's almost depressing on the other side of realizing that I'm still the same person. You've heard the saying, wherever you go, there you are. And it's the same thing with money. If you tend to be a happy person, having more money, you're going to use it well. You can accentuate your happiness. If you happen to be a miserable person, you can be way more miserable with more money. But the bottom line is, in our research, this belief that more money, more stuff's going to make me happier, solve all my problems, is associated with terrible financial outcomes.
Well, and I kind of view it as like the Maslow's hierarchy, right? And with that is money kind of knocks out the bottom too. Because if you don't have money, you're struggling for shelter and food. And like, it's like becomes this thing and you've got to get past that point, right? Like you have to be able to make your rent, you know, move into a safer neighborhood, all that kind of stuff, security for retirement, an emergency fund, get out of debt, what all that is, because that just knocks out those bottom two. But then as you rise on that hierarchy, right? Like it doesn't deal with your self-esteem, your cognitive beliefs, self-actualization. None of that has to do with money. Money does get you past a certain point and it can help with that. Maybe it helps you buy a therapist or, you know, helps you improve some of your other beliefs. So you have a diminishing return on money and it does make you happier. But I do think you do have to get past a certain level of wealth to knock out some of that safety, psychological well-being, right?
Definitely leaks into the love and belongingness and esteem part too. But it's not, it's a shocking number of Americans will admit that they would marry for money, by the way, men and women, which is fascinating. It's definitely part of the picture. And I don't know, growing up, I felt kind of bad about myself around status because, you know, I didn't have the sports car that other people my age who came from wealthier families had, that sort of thing. And I'm bringing this up because that connection between money and status, it is, first of all, it's there and it's real. And if you don't harness that, you are going to destroy yourself financially. That's the other thing that people see on social media around millionaires that is a total myth. They suck you into buying stuff. It almost to a person, the people flexing, you know, luxury watches and cars, standing in front of mansions, they're always selling you something. And what they're trying to do is sell you status. You know, yeah. they want you to feel this sense of a lack of status, a lack of love, a lack of belonging, a lack of self-esteem. And then they want to sell you the cure, which is always some sort of get rich quick scheme. And the problem is, that's actually not how rich people spend their money. And this has been researched, you know, Millionaire Next Door. I did a study where we looked at about 1,000 people who range from ultra high net worth to middle class. This was this particular study. We looked at the ultra wealthy group. They had $11 million in net worth. Okay. We compared them to the group of people who had $500,000 in net worth. Now, granted, that's solid, like upper middle class in the US. And then we asked them, how much money did you spend on your last car, watch, vacation, and house? And this is what shocked me. And I was shocked by this. That group that had about 18 times more money only spent twice as much on those things. You would expect that they would spend 18 times more. They only spent twice as much. And I mentioned this on social media when I'm teaching. It's like, what does that tell you about that mindset? Now, first of all, most of them are self-made too. What does that tell you about their mindset when it comes to spending?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because you get diminishing returns. At the end of the day, I think they realize a car just gets you where you want to go. And I feel like it was in Millionaire Next Door where they broke down the top 10 cars of millionaires. And I want to say like a Toyota is still like number one. It like doesn't even matter. Like they still, that's just the number one car of millionaires still, right?
Right. Well, and people think, but can I go buy stuff once I become wealthy? And it's the wrong question. It's the wrong question. So first of all, of course you can, but that's the wrong question. The question is, what is the mindset of those people who become wealthy? And the mindset of those people who become wealthy is they're looking for financial freedom. They're not looking at stuff. And if you have a stuff focus, it's going to be really tough to get there. And so the question is, what, once I have much money, then can I buy the Lambo? It's like, it's the wrong question. It's the wrong question. Of course you can, but people who ask that question rarely become ultra wealthy.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. But then I also think on the outside looking in, there's this belief that money is bad as a result of the people that are spending this money on it, right? Like they're like, look at all these millionaires and billionaires that don't pay their taxes and have these things. And it's like money's bad as a result, I feel like.
Yeah, absolutely. So that in our studies, we found that to be one of the most destructive beliefs around money.
Oh, okay.
The belief that we call it money avoidance. And by the way, this is associated with lower income, lower net worth, self-destructive financial behaviors, a whole host of terrible, terrible financial outcomes. So if you have this belief, I strongly suggest you alter it in some form or fashion. But that is the belief that rich people are greedy, money corrupts, there's virtue in living with less money. And I'll tell you, I grew up with this belief. I mean, this is a very common belief, you know, when you come from a lower income environment. And the challenge is that there's plenty of examples of terrible, horrible rich people. As a matter of fact, you will never stop finding them if that's what you're looking for. And so in psychology, we call that a confirmation bias, right? Where you are going to then go find all the information that supports your belief that rich people are bad, rich people are greedy. Now, not to get too nerdy, but we just talked about money worship, which is the belief that more money is going to make you happier, solve all your problems. What is fascinating, Robert, is that the people who most strongly believe that rich people are greedy are also the ones who most strongly, desperately want to become rich themselves. Okay. And this correlation is like 0.45, which is just a ridiculously high correlation.
Yeah.
So the more people, you know, actually hate rich people, one of the reasons is because they desperately want to be rich themselves. And I'm not picking on them because what happens is they start to get some success and then they sabotage themselves. They start to have some financial, successes, business successes, and then they give away all the money because they're bouncing between these two beliefs.
And I just think this story that you're telling right now to me is kind of the picture of American money conversations on the national level these days, where it's on one side, we, you know, are so mad at these billionaires and millionaires and eat the rich, tax the wealthy, whatnot. But then on the same hand, like on the other hand is like, it's like the American dream to start your own business, go be successful, go buy a house, you know, and a house these days requires a certain level of income and all this stuff. And so it's like, it's so interesting because I'm just like, it feels so hypocritical, but like at the same time, I'm so confused because it's like, we hate them, we want to be them, and none of it makes sense to me.
I know. And I'm always just sort of curious about it because, in my opinion, is that the people who have all these negative beliefs about capitalism, money, the rich, all this, some of these people, in my opinion, are like some of the best people, you know, they have the best intentions. They want to make the world a better place. They're very caring individuals. And the irony for me is I want those people to be rich. I mean, because, you know, you can do a lot of great in the world and you can have a tremendous impact if you have money. And a lot of ultra wealthy people do tremendously incredible, wonderful things in the world. That's also the truth around money. It's like, yes, there are rich people who are terrible human beings. By the way, there's a bunch of poor people who are terrible human beings too. And there's a bunch of rich people who do incredible good things in the world. And same thing with people who don't have money. So money doesn't make your character at all. You can be wealthy and be a good person. And to become wealthy, you don't have to hurt anyone. You don't have to take advantage of anyone. Your example of working at Target, working at McDonald's, working at Burger King. So let's say that you are saving and investing 20% of your income and you're just putting it off there in your 401k and all of a sudden you become a millionaire. who did you hurt to get there? The answer is nobody. So you do not have to hurt people to become wealthy.
Well, and I think that's also a very common mindset. And I don't know if there's a term for it, but it's like everyone kind of, I don't know everyone, but a lot of people believe it's like a zero sum game where it's like, for me to get ahead, I have to put the other people down. And I don't necessarily believe that. I'm a big kind of like rising tide rises all boats. Like, you know, we can all get better together by helping each other and growing and building knowledge and wealth.
I agree. And, you know, the idea that the system is rigged and that we need a bunch of people to be poor to elevate the rich and all this. I actually I don't get into politics around it at all. If I felt like that would be useful, then I would do it. but, you know, the belief that it's impossible for me or that the system is rigged. Well, first of all, yeah, the system is rigged. Okay. So just understand that, but that I cannot succeed because of it. It's like, there's a few different systems out there. And if you want to succeed, you just have to learn how to succeed in the system.
Well, and I think that's it. I don't know if it's rigged or not rigged, but there's definitely rules to this game. And if you understand the rules, you can play the game very effectively. But if you also just want to live in denial about the rules or you don't like the rules of the game, it's very hard because, look, the game's moving. The game's being played here. And you can decide that I don't like these rules and I don't want to play. But guess what? Like, it's going to be very hard to get ahead in that game if you don't want to play the game.
Well, it's true. And like, it just depends on which system you're talking about, because the system to keep people poor involves payday loans. It involves, you know, really high credit card debt. It involves a bunch of predatory stuff that's out there to try to extract more money from poor people. Like, that exists. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. It absolutely exists. And there are entire industries that are built upon trying to separate you from your money. There's also another system that you can immediately shift to. That's the interesting thing, is believing that you're stuck in one. You can immediately shift to a different system, which is around, oh, I'm going to save and invest, and I'm going to downsize, and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to do what rich people do, and I'm going to do how people become rich. You have immediate access to that. You have immediate access to that.
Love it. Well, I want to change gears because you say you don't talk politics, but one of the areas that you kind of harped on a lot in the last 6 months or 9 months, and it's not super political, but I think it's really important to touch on, is going to college and the value of college. And should you go to college these days? And of course, yesterday, as we're recording this, it was the Supreme Court hearing on the student loan forgiveness thing.
Are they going to forgive them yet, Robert? I just feel like it's more promises that never get delivered from our government.
I don't know. You know, it's in the Supreme Court's hands now. So with that being said, though, what is the value?
Pelosi already said that president can't do it. So, I mean, is that she must have been referring to law.
So we'll it's one of those things. It's, you know, I don't think he has the power. Some people think he has the power. Again, not getting political, but what I think the problem with this whole debate, what I think people are like, you know, missing everything, is that the reason we have a student loan crisis and the reason we have all these problems and people want to forgive debt is because the value of college itself, people are not getting the ROI they once were. And
is that true?
Yeah, I think it is true. The people borrowed too much to pay for something, and now they're not seeing an ROI to support the loans that they have, right?
Is that true? I'm not sure that's true, Robert.
That's my belief. That's why I'm asking you.
So first of all, I hear all the time, college isn't worth it anymore. Okay. So first of all, you have to understand this. I don't really care. I just want the truth. Okay.
100%.
Like, I can care less. What I do is I'm like, oh, is that right? So I just heard this from someone on social media that I think says some good stuff. And so what I do is I go then research. I'm like, okay, so college must not be worth it anymore. So I go look. And every time I go look, Robert, what I find is that it's absolutely worth it. On average, the average college grad right now, okay, when they ask like, how much are you making each week? It's over $1.2 million more during their lifetime. That's the average college grad. I'm not talking doctor. I'm talking 4-year college grad on average. So let's do the math. $1.2 million more during your lifetime. The average college debt is around $40,000. It's slightly less than that.
$38,000, something like that. Yeah.
So somebody pull out your calculator. $1.2 million minus $38,000. And I got to say, I land on the college is still worth it. In general. However, I also make videos all the time, and people get really mad at me for doing this, where I go look and say, which degrees are worth it? And there are degrees out there that will pay you less than minimum wage. And if you go get one of those, college is absolutely not worth it for you. It was a terrible decision to go. And you were probably lied to some degree. And again, this is one of those things where college is a business decision. It's an absolute business decision. And if you go to college to get a low paying degree in something that you love, by the way, that's fine. Just make sure you have rich parents. That's my piece of advice. If you're going to college because you want to better your life, you want to pull your family out of poverty, you know, it's a business decision and you better start researching what are the jobs that are available? How much do they pay? How much is this college degree going to cost me? Can I go someplace and get it cheaper? You know, have you thought about that? I know that one college sounds great. But Robert, you know, I have great respect for you. You have great respect for me. I have no idea what college you went to. You don't know what college I went to. It never even comes up.
No one cares anymore after you're like, you know, so I just want to say two things. So I 100% agree with your math. I will say though, there's actually one area that I think you missed. And to me, it's what is the net present value of that $1 million? So it's one thing to say that I earn $1 million over 40 years. That's cool. But I'm going to spend this money today, $40,000. Would that $40,000 grow? And so I'll share with you, you're still not wrong in your math.
I'm going to jump on you on the other side of this.
I hope so.
Better keep this argument going.
I do. So if we take this net present value of, you know, I have it as 900,000 for men, 650,000 for women is what they earn from getting a bachelor's degree. It breaks down. There's a ton of assumptions. We're talking 40 years, interest rates, yada, yada, yada.
Your best assumptions before I share with you my thoughts.
I peg the number of a value of college, if you net present value it, to be roughly $100,000 for men, $70,000 for women. So the argument still goes, if you spend $38,000-$40,000, you still have a 2x ROI, maybe 3x ROI on college. But we all know that. So I actually did a study of the 20 most expensive colleges in the United States this year. And the tuition cost is over $60,000 for 1 year. So you could be into it for $240,000 to go to college. Now, granted, we also know that not everyone pays sticker price, which I also think is so absurd, right? You have people that pay zero. You have people that pay full list. You have people that pay everywhere in between. Yeah. But to me, it's you could really run the risk of a negative ROI. And it does vary by career. I will say there's an amazing thing for anyone watching called it's FREEOP. I can't tell you the initials, but it's a nonprofit company and they're a research firm and they put together the value of 30,000 undergraduate programs. And they do this, like you said, there's some terrible majors out there that you overpay. There's some like an engineer, you almost have a 99% chance of being a positive ROI if you go into engineering today as an undergraduate major. So it definitely varies. But to me, I think that the $1 million, you kind of need to think about it in a net present value situation, which it still has a positive ROI, but the numbers get a lot closer to what you're spending these days. And so you have to be a lot more careful, I think, than you ever had to be. If we went back to 1980, I don't think you had to be as careful with how much you spent on college versus how much you're going to earn. Whereas today, those margins have compressed so much that you have to be a lot more mindful of that decision. I'll turn it over to you. What are you thinking?
All right. So challenge with that. So first of all, I totally agree with you. If you're going to look at whether it's that 40,000 in loans or whatever, you know, and so here's my problem, my big issue with that approach. So first of all, the math works, but let's run the scenario. I'm 18 years old. I'm broke. I have no money. My family has no money. Robert, the only way I was able to go to college was student loans. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't for student loans, I would have never been able to go. I got a tennis scholarship too. So if it wasn't for those scholarships and that kind of thing, I never would have been able to go. So the big problem is, if you had given me $40,000 when I was 18, then your math matters. But for me, it's like, there's no way I could even get $40,000. The only way I could get it was to get student loans because I was pursuing a degree. So that's where I get what you're saying. If I'm a wealthy parent and I'm sitting here with 250 grand and I'm like, should I put my kid in school for this or should I just invest it for the net return? And then they can just get an unskilled labor job somewhere for the rest of their life or whatever. That's my issue with the math is thinking about, first of all, if you're wealthy, who cares what you're going to do? Like, you're fine. You want to get an art degree. So here's my issue too. Like, some of these majors that we say are bad majors are beautiful majors. Are you kidding me? You're going to get a degree in art. I mean, do you know how important art is? But the problem is that throughout history, to make money as an artist, you never could. You had to get a patron to like fund your life. And so that's been the history of art, unfortunately. But for me, it's those low income people who have no earning potential. Very clearly you can make more money, and it's up to 1.2 or higher in terms of the net return. So anyway, that's my issue with starting with that. If you gave me 50,000 and then I would rest assured I would invest it and not take it out and buy an F-150, which is probably what I would have done at age 18. Yep. And I couldn't touch it and it was locked away, then I think that math makes sense. But when I'm sitting here talking to the average person, the young person, I can't even see their face. It's like, it's pretty hard to argue against college.
No, absolutely. But I do think one, college isn't the fit for everybody. I still think it's actually the fit for the majority of young adults that are graduating high school. But I would say I put it at 60%. I don't even know if I'd go much farther, because I do think that there's a lot of value in things like the trades and that kind of stuff. Because I would also say you have 4 years of spending this $40,000, where could you save for $40,000 if you went out and got a job? You know, I think of some military kids too that I know that, you know, it's a lot of them go out and buy the F-150. They just do. But like, you know, I also know the kid that like bought a house at every duty station for 20 years and now has like 7 rentals because they lived in it and then they moved to the next duty station and then they, you know, so. You know, I guess my whole thing is both of this whole conversation, we're talking about the average. So
yeah, that's the hard part.
That's the hard part. So that means that there's 50% of people that exceeded that and 50% of people that didn't. So it's like, I want you to have a mindset. I know you do too, Brad, of people that are getting that above the 50% mean because they're making better financial decisions. I'll also say that, you know, for that young adult kid and you're looking at the cost of college, I talk to a lot of high school kids. And one thing that it warms my heart every year is that most of them actually have a better understanding of this math than we give them credit for. The hard part is they have a hard time overcoming the finance or the psychology of their family. And what I mean by this is mom and dad went to a private school and they want their kid to go there. Or the idea that they might go to community college for 2 years, which is free in most states, and then transfer to a state school has a stigma attached to it that they don't want to necessarily talk to Aunt Sally about at, you know, Thanksgiving. And you're just going to your community college. And, you know, but then meanwhile, you have that friend in the friend group that's going to Harvard. And so then, like, you know, everyone has this weird stigma. And so I think these kids, they actually struggle more internally with that than they do with the financial aspect of the decision.
That's true. There's nothing more depressing than your senior year walking around and everybody seems to know exactly what they want to do, right? So I worked in a high school for 20 years as a psychologist. And I'm going to tell you right now, none of them actually know what they want to do. They're all struggling, right? Nobody knows what they really are going to do when they're 18. But to your point too, like, I mean, I went to community college, you know, the credits were cheaper over there. Uh-huh. I mean, I had that mindset from day one, like this is a business decision. And so I think that's the way to approach it. I have nothing but respect for people who go to community college. And by the way, too, like when it comes to trades, too, absolutely. When you look at the relationship between income and education, it goes like this. So 2 year, you're going to make way more than high school or less than high school, bachelor's more, master's more, doctor professional degree more. And so I feel like if you're going to go to college, before you even go, you need to go to the Occupational Outlook Handbook. And you need to decide, picture, what is it you want to do? See if there's any jobs, see what they pay, and then work backwards from there. Because one opportunity cost, maybe you put this in your formula or not too, is going to college for 4 years. Like that's 4 years you're not working. Yeah. And so in terms of your average income, that you have to take that into consideration too. For me, the opportunity cost, I went to school till I was 29 to get my doctorate. I mean, that's a lot of years of being poor basically and not making money. So it's an absolute business decision. And I think people need to start with the end in mind.
Well, and I think what's so cool is today we live in this day and age where there's so much data and transparency, more so than when I went to high school. You know, you just said an occupational handbook and I was like, oh man, I remember this thing. It's like this, you know, now you can go to Glassdoor, you can Google it. You can literally Google like, what is the average salary of a nurse in California? And like, it doesn't even like, it just comes up right at the top. So it's like,
the occupational handbook is online right now. Okay. So I use it all the time. Yeah. Same one I used back in college.
Right. But like, there's just so much information today. And there's also what I think is so cool is that there's so many alternative ways to pay for college. So, you know, I never actually want to dismiss the people that want to go into art and teaching and all these things. Yeah. We need them. We literally need them in our society. But I also think that unless you have a patron grandfather that is going to pay for it, you know, there are a lot of alternative ways to go to college these days, which I think are amazing. So like we said, community college, there's a lot of employers now that'll pay for college. So like, I always think of my Target days. Target offered tuition reimbursement when I was there, get $5,000 a year, but now they have a partnership where you can get like 200 plus colleges where you can get a bachelor's degree for free. And like, they'll pay for this stuff. And I think Starbucks, Walmart, Chick-fil-A, a lot of companies do the same thing. And man, it's like, if I was 18, I didn't know what I wanted to do yet, go get a job, because one, I think, you know, working actually like opens your eyes to like the world. Like, do you like this career field? Do you like engaging with other humans? Do you understand how this works? Maybe you want to go into something different. I actually, one of the internships I did was at a brokerage house, and I didn't know this. I was like 19 years old, and it was the people that we talk about on TikTok, Brad. It was this, but I didn't know this. And they were selling these life insurance policies and closed-end funds and like some really dirty financial products. But when I was 19, I was like, man, this guy rolls up in like a Bentley and like works 2 days in the office and plays golf like most of the week and like yada yada. And I thought that was kind of cool. And then I started doing the math and I was like, this is kind of terrible and unscrupulous, but and it's like I didn't want to do that. And then, you know, you work at Target, and I actually like doing that. I like talking to people and leading teams, but you learn a little something every step of the way, because no, like you said, no 17 or 18 year old really knows what they want to do. And I think the data supports that, like only like 20% of people actually work in their college degree field, right? Like everyone moves on. Like they start with something and they go on to something different, right?
I just love your advice too, to look for alternative ways to get that college degree. And I'll be the first one to make videos saying college isn't worth it anymore. You know, I'll be the first one doing it.
But that's the thing. It is worth it, but there's just, you have to have that asterisk.
Yes,
it's worth it to a certain amount of money. You can definitely overpay for it. It's an investment decision. People overpay for houses. Then, you know, people get all mad because they're underwater on their houses. Kind of what happened in 2007, 2008, right? Like you overpaid, you got screwed. You hopefully learned a lesson and you moved on. I just, the problem is to me, it's that, you know, student loan debt's very hard to get out of. You're sold the promise that it's always a good investment. I don't necessarily think it is.
You're absolutely right. It is not, sometimes it's a terrible investment. It depends on a lot of factors.
Yep. And like, I think people are sold on this. And then I think we have this community cultural pressure that like, at least we did. I think the pendulum swinging back in a little bit, but like when I was graduating high school, everyone had to go to high school and it was like, or sorry, everyone had to go to college. And if you didn't, you were a failure and yada, yada. And now I think it's still, like I said, majority should probably do it, but like the pendulum swinging in a little bit on this, like, all or nothing kind of mindset, right?
Yeah, on average, you should strongly consider it. That's
hedging your bet. I like it.
Matters. Like there's some terrible ways to go about it. And this is the hard part too. When you're 18, 19, you don't, what do you know? Like that's the hard part. The other thing that drove me nuts were the, you know, and again, I'm not into politics because I work with individuals and we have a system we're in and I want to win in the system. Mm-hmm. And I applaud people who want to change the system. You know, they're smarter than me. Like, I don't know what system to change it to that's worked. And there's evidence to show that it's worked better. I leave that to other people. And when they change the system, I will then learn how to hack it and try to share everything I can with everybody. So, I mean, for me, it's about figuring out the rules, figuring out how can I thrive? How have people like me who came from where I came from, look like me, same obstacles, how have they made it? And then what I want to do is sort of replicate their path to success. And I think that there are many more paths to success now than there were when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so, and they're just
exciting.
I love that too, because I think, you know, we live in this day and age where, you know, you can pull out your phone and you have access to so much and you can earn like literally 24/7. And then, you know, there's pros and cons to that. As a result, like things are happening 24/7, which can kind of be overwhelming and stressful and, you know, this mobile and who knows, but like the opportunities are endless. And like, I hear about new jobs and side hustles. Like, this is an amazing one, Brad. I heard about this kid. I did a podcast with his mom. And his side hustle is selling cockroaches online. Like, I'm not even joking, right? It's like, how is this even a thing? And he's like, well, we live in Alabama and this cockroach is the only place in the country that this cockroach exists. And he's like, I ship it to colleges and universities everywhere. And I make about $500 a month because I just go out in my backyard. I pack them up and I ship them out. I'm like, how is this a thing? But like, this is what I mean. There's so much opportunity out there if you just, you know, explore.
Yeah, that's incredible. And also too, like the whole college decision or not college decision. I mean, first of all, again, I have to go hard on it's a business decision unless you're mm-hmm. come from a rich family. So that's number one. And then number two, it's not just about that. It's trying to figure out what's going to be a fulfilling life for you. Like, you're going to spend a lot of time working in one capacity or another. And what do you see yourself doing? What do you want to do? Maybe it doesn't require a college degree. Or and I lump trade schools in there too, because most of those are out of college, like community college.
Yep.
So it's a 2-year degree, but like, what is it you want to do? And to your point, like, I worked all the way through college, and for me, maybe it was the jobs I had, but I'm like, I'm going to keep going to college. Cause what I figured out was the longer you go, the more money you make for
the
doing
harder
less
it is to
work.
Get out. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, for doing less work, like in the summer, I'm sweating, shoveling 20 tons of asphalt every day. I couldn't wait to get back to college. I'm like, this is the easiest thing ever. Sleeping until noon, you know, playing some tennis, taking some classes. But I was in there hustling, trying to figure out how can I make the most money possible while sweating the least. That was sort of my mindset.
I love it. But that's good. And I also think the other thing with the student loan debt side is the value of a graduate degree. And this is one I don't think anyone really talks about a whole lot. And, you know, yes, the stats say that you have more potential income, but, you know, it is a diminishing slope at that point in time. There's a big jump up from like no degree to associates to bachelor's. And then it's like a little less and a little less, but the costs magnify significantly. And so I will say that any stat you see of someone that has over $100,000 in student loan debt, almost all of them have a graduate degree. And so as you're in your career, and this is targeted to maybe teachers and certain ones, like, you really need to do a cost benefit analysis before you make that leap to go get a graduate degree. Cause I know a lot of companies also like, oh, I'll give you $5,000 more, you know, or you get a raise or you get something, but it's like, that could be a really steep hurdle to potentially earn more.
That's right. And like for teaching too, as an example, sometimes it's even harder to get a job because you're on a pay scale and they're like, oh, we got to pay this person more. Yeah. And by the way, it's not a lot more. And so I think you're absolutely right. And to me, that's where it's like, what would this degree actually do for you financially? Like, again, mm-hmm. if you want to study it because you love education and you can afford it and it doesn't matter, go for it. You know, but many of us are doing it because we are trying to better our lives financially. And you really have to pay attention. Like, you know, how is this master's or doctorate actually going to improve my life, improve my income, allow me to do more of what I want to do?
Love it. Well, we're almost at the top of the hour, and I know that you have to go, Brad, but how about you give everyone a quick rundown of where they can find you, where they could read about you, any last takeaways too? I'm going to put up your beautiful looking headshot on your website there on the screen, but yeah, share a little about where people can find you.
So I am Dr. Brad Klontz on most social media. So TikTok, live streaming on TikTok right now. I see a commenter there. And so I'm really trying to I do a lot of stuff, but really on social media, I'm just trying to focus on education around the psychology of money and our choices we make and investing. So most of my content, you know, 99% of it's free. I have books out there and courses, that kind of thing. But that's really what I'm here on social media to do, is to try to challenge some of those myths about millionaires and try to empower as many people as I can on, you know, first of all, it comes with learning that, oh, I can do this, like, you can. And so that's the message I give people. As I said, I worked in a low-income high school for 20 years, and I spent a lot of time showing people how they can continue to work at McDonald's or Burger King the rest of their lives and be a millionaire when they hit retirement age. So it's possible for everybody. And so that's the message I'm trying to spread.
I love it. Thanks so much for being here, Brad. I really appreciate it. Thanks for taking your time. And thanks everyone for watching, listening. I see your comments as well, and I appreciate it. Thanks everyone. See you next week.
You bet. Thanks, Robert.